Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Karp, who's a professor of history at Princeton University and the author of This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. And he has an article at Jacobin Magazine, 51% Losers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Karp.
Hi. Thanks for having me in.
Well, thanks, Matt. And you were arguing in your article that the midterms have given the Democratic Party a boost, but the party's professional class politics are a cul-de-sac and that we desperately need a political revolution driven by the needs and aspirations of the multiracial working class. So now you have all of these idealistic young freshman congresspeople coming into the Democratic Party. And the first argument out of the gate is whether or not to make Nancy Pelosi the speaker. The arguments in favor of her is that she's great at raising funds. And the arguments against her from these freshman class, who were probably similar to the influx that happened in 1974, is basically, well, we on the campaign trail said that we didn't support her. And the first vote you're asking us to make is to elect her. So back to politics as usual. Is that what's happening?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You know, the fight to depose Pelosi is not being led right now by the left. It's sort of, even though I think, you know, a lot of left-wing, some of the left-wing candidates like, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, most prominently have been very critical of Nancy Pelosi. It seems like, from what I gather, although I haven't tracked this like a reporter would have tracked this, but my understanding is that the Seth Moulton and some of the sort of more centrist, actually, and some of the sort of new suburban candidates that they just elected in these sort of swing districts are the ones who are most keen to immediately dump Pelosi. I'm not sure how well the access over Pelosi lines up with this. I mean, in my view, Pelosi does kind of represent the sort of liberal but very class-bound sort of politics that the Democrats, from a left-wing perspective, the Democrats are really hobbled by and you know, are unable to sort of address the larger crises that are affecting our society. But at the same time, I'm not at all confident that this movement against Pelosi will replace her with anybody, at least as it's currently in the shape it's currently in. I'm not confident that it will replace her with anybody better on that front. Sure. We'll see. We'll see. The left, the kind of progressive caucus, hasn't really moved so far.
Well, I brought it up because Nancy Pelosi does represent a wealthy district, and you argue in your article that the Democrats have become the party of the prosperous. Now, to be fair, I think the Republicans are still, if the Democrats are the party of millionaires, the Republicans are the party of billionaires. But the statistic that you show is pretty alarming, that of the wealthiest 40 districts in this country, 35 of them just elected a Democrat, and of the wealthiest 50, 42 of them just elected a Democrat. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, the nature of our system, I guess, when you have, you know, only two parties really are competitive, that both parties can be at least present themselves as and actually operate as parties of the prosperous. So it's unquestionable that the Republicans draw a lot of support from the rich. And I think, according to exit polls, they still maintain a slim advantage, although that advantage is narrower than it's almost ever been before in terms of wealthy people making over six figures voting almost 50-50 between Republican and Democrat now, which is so different from the way things used to be even 20 years ago. Yeah, I mean, I don't think so far this movement, I mean, there's a lot of debate out there. And, you know, the reaction to the article, you know, a lot of people continue to say that, hey, actually, if you look at who these middle class voters, even these upper middle class voters, actually, they are feeling economic insecurity. And that's what's leading them to sort of support progressive policy. And this really isn't such a problem, because the Orange County, California, and Fairfax County, Virginia are actually going to be all in for Medicare for all. Personally, I'm not convinced yet. I'm skeptical that this path, even as it may have been, you know, tactically necessary to get to 51% in the House of Representatives, I'm worried that the longer term coalition it's building actually deepens the divide in the working class and creates a party that doesn't have a lot of incentive to not to sort of talk about progressive policy, but to fight for it. I'm skeptical that all of these members from these rich districts, however individually, you know, kind of they may position themselves ideologically, when push comes to shove, we see a lot of, you know, we saw Bill de Blasio. Few national politicians were more showily progressive than Bill de Blasio. But then when Amazon came knocking, you know, he was first in line to, you know, spend a couple billion dollars on tax breaks for this mega billion-dollar company rather than, you know, fixing the subway. So I just don't trust that individual sort of ideological pronouncements are going to overcome a support base that leans more and more on people who don't actually need these things in the same way that working class people may.
Well, as you point out in your article, President Obama's former press secretary, Jay Carney, is now a senior vice president at Amazon, and he was the face of Amazon's big announcement of where they were putting their new facilities in suburban Washington, in Virginia,
right,
and in New York. So I was speaking earlier in the program with Nancy McLean, who wrote the book Democracy in Chains, pointing out the power of the plutocracy and particularly of the Koch brothers. And the other day I spoke with Larry Lessig at Harvard, who made a very pungent and telling point. He said, it's sort of diagnosing America at the moment succinctly. He said that a handful of Americans making $10,000 an hour have managed to convince a lot of Americans making $40 an hour that the biggest problem facing America are people earning $8 an hour.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's a nice formulation. I do think the class dynamics, you know, of the sort of our party politics are in some ways, you know, I mean, historically, look, I study the 19th century as my job, and I'm aware, as you know, as you know, some critics have pointed out, that, you know, this isn't new in a certain sense, that the American working class has always been sort of riven by, has always struggled with sort of ethno-cultural tensions, racial tensions, all these divisions, you know, often enhanced and exaggerated very intentionally on the part of various, you know, sort of upper class groups. And so in that sense, it's the assumption shouldn't be, the starting assumption shouldn't be, oh, of course the working class should, you know, automatically be united and to resist the sort of economic exploitation of their betters. That's the rare case, not the normal one. And yet, you know, from my perspective as somebody on the left, that's still the kind of politics that I think are necessary, as unlikely and as unsuccessful as it's been so far. And to me, so the idea that, you know, certain mega billionaires on the right, for instance, would be really interested in kind of demonizing a foreign other or a really poor kind of underclass in order to win lower middle class or even working class votes, that's a standard tactic of the right. That's divide and rule. That's of course, they're going to employ racial divisions and, you know, just white racism, appeals to white identity, to sort of underline, sort of enhance their appeal to those voters. What's more troubling to me in a certain way is that a lot of elite Democrats and liberals increasingly seem to be sort of willing to let white working class voters go and, in effect, write them off as sort of outside the boundaries of any kind of class politics. I mean, favor of just sticking with the current coalition in which, you know, largely wealthy metropolitan, you know, college-educated Democrats run the ship, and the votes, in to a large extent, come from non-white working-class voters who really have nowhere else to go, and who are, you know, by the numbers, already not enthusiastic voters in the same way that the upper-class voters are. So I just think that whole division is not just on the Republican side, because, you know, from my perspective, the right wing is always going to employ these divisions and this kind of their main struggle is to preserve minority rule, in a sense. Whereas the party of the left, the kind of progressive, democratic, egalitarian party, our mission, and I guess I am speaking as a partisan here, our mission is to harness the many against the few. And so I do find it sort of pernicious when Democrats seem to be moving away from at least a large chunk of the many. That's how I see it.
Well, allow me to offer up a little optimism.
that, okay. Please.
from the election results, and that is the extent to which, and Bernie Sanders showed the way earlier, but the fact that Beto O'Rourke outraised Cruz, he certainly didn't win, unfortunately, but he outraised Cruz with small donors. And my sense is that the way that the powerful in this country have captured our politics is that they've made our politics about money, not about candidates and policies and ideas, but about money. And Citizens United has given that the stamp of approval of the courts to the extent that...
I thought you were going to give me good news.
No, well, I'm just laying the groundwork here that they... Yeah, you've got dark money, 40% at least of the money that went into this last election was dark money, and that's the victory of the Koch brothers. But I'm suggesting here that what's happened to all of our politicians, both Republican and Democrat, is that they become telemarketers. They spend their days dialing for dollars. And that is the way that the ruling class captures them and controls them. So if you can find an end run around that, because the paradox that the Democrats have is that they get their money from the same donor class as the Republicans, but the Republicans have a natural fit with the donor class ideologically and politically. Whereas the Democrats have to lie to their constituents in order to get the money from the donor class who are screwing their voters.
Yeah, and there has to be an end run around that, and I'm not sure where it is. I mean, I know, so in a national race like the 2016 primary, and in an effectively national race, or you know, Texas is you know literally was a nation, and in my book it was a nation. It's still in virtually a nation in extent. A vast kind of race like that, it does seem like it's possible for talented candidates to overcome structural advantages and outraise their opponents, but. If you look at I just wonder if that's possible at district races or even on races in poorer, smaller states, and let alone state legislature type races. If the small donor solution is one that can work, I know I was sort of did some work for Julia Salazar, who is a kind of socialist candidate who ran on the Democratic line in Brooklyn. For state senate, and her campaign, I don't know how much they just basically didn't think that small donors, unless you could kind of nationalize the race, which didn't really happen except at the end for other reasons, it was hard to kind of count on that influx of cash. So I don't know how to make that possible if you're running, say, for Ohio legislature to sort of tap into that. And I worry that it might not be there, actually, aside from a few showpiece races. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I don't know that it's a solution, but it's a partial solution. I think the greater problems with our democracy, if we can take the liberty of calling it that, is the structural problems into the future. By 2040, the Republicans will control 70 Senate seats and the Democrats only 30, because people are moving from the red states into the blue states, where the population gets concentrated in blue state urban centers, and their votes get diluted as a result because of the Electoral College and because of gerrymandering. So as long as the Republicans control the Senate into the future, they will control the courts. And we're reaching a point of a threshold now where the bad news from this election is more Republican senators will vote through more dreadful judges that Trump will be foisting on the judiciary, to the point where it may have crossed the point of no return.
Yeah, there's not much good news on that front either. I mean, I think zooming out, and this wasn't the focus of my piece, but I think other commentators, Jed Purdy in Dissent and elsewhere, pointed out how this really deepens the problem of democracy and the problem of minority rule. And, the Republican assault on voting rights, in places like Georgia, but also just the sort of structural dependence on via in effect the Constitution, the Electoral College, and the power of the Supreme Court on these sort of anti-majoritarian institutions causes a real problem. So in that sense, I mean, if your diagnosis of the moment is the most important thing to do is to claw back at this anti-majoritarian power by any means necessary, then in that sense, I do have some sympathy with, flooding the suburbs, flooding anywhere where you think you can make a dent. And in that sense, I'm not so much being ultra critical of even the Democratic leadership's tactics in that regard. But I just wonder in the longer run, if you're at all interested in building any kind of, especially, with organized labor losing steam and power and influence every day under the under the pressure from Republican courts. To me, the only way to actually break the cycle in the longer run, rather than simply, you know, at best, you know, trade power with minority rule Republicans, the only way to actually sort of build towards creating a full majority rule society is empowering the working class. And I worry that the sort of Democratic turn away from that won't serve that project in the long run.
Well, let me just read the last paragraph of your article, which I think makes a powerful case in that regard. The only power to curtail the rising empire of finance in the United States, W.E.D. Du Bois wrote during the Gilded Age, was industrial democracy, votes and intelligence in the hands of the laboring class, black and white, north and south. And the hands of the laboring class in the struggle against capitalist power, they are the only thing that can save us. That was true in 1868, it was true in 1938, and it remains true in 2018. So, I mean, I don't think you'll get an argument out of me or any of our listeners that the Democratic Party should return to its roots. Easier said than done, and I find it a crying shame that this complete con man, interloper, fraud, Donald Trump, has managed to capture a lot of the white working class. It's absolutely heartbreaking.
It is. And I think, I don't want to be, again, I don't want to pretend as if there aren't major obstacles, you know, in terms of the power and the ongoing power of Trump's sort of nativist and, you know, sort of racist appeal to a lot of these voters. That being said, I think as sort of I quoted a piece by the political scientist Lily Geismer and Matt Lasseter in the article, I think, you know, we can't, as we talk about the rise of Trump or the rise of a sort of a populist, you know, right that, you know, makes winning appeals to white working class voters, we can't leave out the other side of the equation, which is the way in which Democratic policy, even under, certainly under Clinton, but then even under Obama, really pivoted away from labor liberalism. Obama, you know, just the truth is he didn't prioritize. He campaigned on doing the Employee Free Choice Act. Labor leaders were really hopeful that he was going to prioritize that. And for whatever reason, after the financial crisis, didn't prioritize it at all. Neither did the congressional or senatorial Democrats. They had 60 votes and they couldn't do a thing for organized labor. And then, you know, when the housing bubble popped, you know, he had Goldman Sachs guy Tim Geithner running the Treasury Department, and they bailed out the banks and not the homeowners. So, you know, it's like the idea that only Trump and the Republicans are the source of this shift on the part of white working class voters just isn't plausible to me. And if we don't get our houses cleaned up at home first and really repudiate those policies, the legacy of those policies, and commit to labor liberalism, if the Democratic Party can't even commit to that, then it's just going to get worse.
Well, Matt Karp, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate the conversation.
All right. Thank you, Ian. And I'm not much more optimistic than I was before, but we'll see.
Well, if you're looking for me to be the font of optimism, I think you come to the wrong place. But
okay.
I try.
Thanks for inviting me on the show, Ian.
I appreciate it. Trying to build a reality-based community in post-truth America.
So it's hard enough to do.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Ian. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Matt Karp, a professor of history at Princeton University and the author of This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. And he has an article at Jacobin Magazine, 51% Losers. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing whether dysfunction in the White House is devolved into dementia.